This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
This is from the Transmission of Light Koan Collection, case 25, Master Sinha. Sinha asked the Buddhist master Haklena, "I want to seek enlightenment. How should I apply my mind?" Haklena said, "If you seek enlightenment, there is no way to apply the mind to it." Sinha said, "If there's no way to apply the mind, who does the work of Buddhas?" Master Haklena said, "If you apply anything, this is not virtue. If you don't contrive a thing, this is the work of Buddhas. The scriptures say, the virtues I practice are not mine." Kazan's verse. "If you want to reveal the great emptiness, just don't cover it up. Thoroughly empty, pure and peaceful, it is originally clear." So this weekend we've been doing an introduction to training retreat. And we're in the first week of our ongoing studying body and mind study of the way. And so I thought this koan would be kind of nice in bringing that together. "I want to seek enlightenment." This student asks, "How do I apply my mind?" Right? A reasonable question. Asking this question, we know that the student has already raised bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is the awakening of the mind from a sleep state, the state in which we believe that if we just keep doing what we've been doing, somehow it's all going to work out. And the awakening is realizing that doesn't appear to be true. And so we begin looking, seeking, questioning, examining. We begin to have doubt in what we may come to understand as samsara, the spinning, the weaving through these cycles that from the Buddhist understanding have been happening for millennia. Master Dogen in the fascicle says, "After resonating with the way and arousing the thought of enlightenment, take refuge in the great way of the Buddha ancestors and devote yourself to the practice of the way-seeking mind. Even if you have not yet aroused the way-seeking mind, follow the examples of the ancestors who did arouse the way-seeking mind in former times." And so this way-seeking mind is the mind that is not just wanting to be free of suffering in our own lives. From the Buddhist perspective, that's just way, way, way too small. One, because it's just too limited to this personal life. It's also small because it's not recognizing that this personal life is not just me. It's all of you. It's everything. It's also too small because from a traditional Buddhist perspective, this life is just one moment in eons of lives, past and going into the future. And so in a certain way, this life is extremely important because this is where, in this time, we have the opportunity to practice, to affect change, to awaken, and to bring that commitment to liberation from suffering to the world. And at the same time, it's just a lifetime. It's just a moment. And so to both wholeheartedly enter into it and at the same time to realize that it passes in a moment. And so that, but even if we haven't aroused that way-seeking mind, which is not just something that happens in one moment, it happens again and again. It's cultivated. Practice cultivates it. Our lives cultivate it. Suffering can cultivate it. But also that if that hasn't yet aroused, that we can look back to those before us, the women, the men, practitioners who are all of these different countries where Buddhism exists, and in people who aren't Buddhists, who don't think in these terms, who have roused a great aspiration to, in their own way, and then in their own language, to awaken. And so when that happens, that demands response. And so the path is presented to us as that response, to live this life. That then raises the question, well, what is the path? What is training? How should I apply my mind? What do I do? If I want to realize enlightenment, if I want to awaken great compassion, what do I do? Master Dogen says, without practice, the Buddha way will not be attained. Without study, it remains remote, distant. We hear about it, we can read about it, we can see people practicing, but it's as though it's something that's happening a long way away. How should I apply my mind? Well, Buddhism has great response to that question. The first thing that happens, for those of you who joined us for the weekend, after a greeting and a meal, is instruction in Zazen, right? Sit this body in this posture of that is awake, like a mountain, and then turn your attention in. Examine, see, let go, return, take responsibility, patience, the Four Noble Truths, point to what do we do, the Eightfold Path, the Eight Gates of Training, in our sitting and working and walking and lying down, in our laughing and crying. Everyone everywhere is engaged in these activities, but what do I as a practitioner do with my mind in these things that I do every day, such to both arouse the way-seeking mind, the desire for enlightenment, but also to enlighten my mind. Master Dogen in the Fast School speaks of everyday mind. He says, everyday mind means to maintain an everyday mind in this world or in any world, that is, wherever you find yourself. Yesterday goes forth from this moment and today comes forth from this place. With going, the boundless sky goes. With coming, the entire earth comes. This is everyday mind. So he's communicating, he's telling us something, right? That it's everyday mind, it's sitting and walking and listening and speaking. But in that, the entire the boundless sky goes forth and the entire earth appears. What is that? So these teachings, the way the Dharma is presented, sometimes speaks directly to your mind that understands. So when we give instruction in Zazen, it's easy to understand. You can do this with your legs. You do this with your hands, right? You do this with your torso. You bring your attention to the breath. You bring your attention to it. You count the breath. You bring your attention back. We can understand all of that, right? And it follows a kind of linear progression, right? That's easy to remember. And so that we can begin to engage it. So that's one kind of teaching. And there are many kind of teaching, there are many teachings that are presented that way, that are easy to remember, and that follow a kind of process, a progress, a progression, right, that we can engage in. And there are other kinds of teachings that work differently. They startle you, right? They like shock your mind. And so when Sinha says, I want to seek enlightenment, how should I apply my mind? It's like, yeah, I want to know too. And I'm expecting the teacher to tell me what to do, right? Do this, do that. But Aklena says, if you seek enlightenment, you can't apply your mind to it. What? And that's the way the koan works.
What?
In other words, you can't resolve it. You can't turn towards that samsaric everyday mind, the mind that knows, the mind that grabs, the mind that measures, the mind that figures it out. I'm going to figure this out. And then it's all going to be better. Right? Well, we're good at figuring things out. We're pretty good at that. Why hasn't anybody figured this out? Maybe it's not like that. Maybe it's not of the nature to do that. Maybe we have to go another way. There is no way to apply the mind to it. And so, of course, that raises the question, what is mind? What is enlightenment that I am seeking? Master Keizan, in his commentary, says, when one truly seeks enlightenment, how could it have anything to do with using the mind? Here we die, there we're born. Though we aspire to enlightenment and seek truth here and there, the fact that now we have not arrived at the ultimate reality is basically because of using this mind. In other words, we're trying to do the same thing we've always done to arrive at a place that is not a place. We're trying to use something which is not a thing to engage in a process which is not a process to obtain something which cannot be obtained. He says, so, if you want to accord with enlightened wisdom, it is not only a matter of detaching from these very views and mental poisons, that is, the views and the attachments and so on that kind of cloud our mind and our actions. He says, we must also let go of the body and the knowledge of the Buddhas. When you practice in this way, you cannot be relegated to the state of the ordinary person or exalted to the rank of a Buddha. In other words, that's not what it's about. It's not about getting from this place, which I'm tired of, to another place, which is going to be excellent. Right? So I'm not stuck in the state of being an ordinary person. But I'm not going to the place of a Buddha. He says, you transcend far beyond any realm of the sense of holy or ordinary and leave behind all assessments of difference and sameness. And this is the great revolution of Buddhism and Buddha Dharma, is transcending, going beyond all dualities. Is it body or is it mind? Is it this way or is it that way? And yet we have to practice. Dogen says, without practice, the Buddha way can't be attained. Without study, it remains distant. We do have to do something. But how do we do something without applying the mind to it? The Buddha said that there are certain conditions for enlightenment, for attaining enlightenment. And of course, he had many ways. He taught for a long, long time. So he had many ways of speaking about this. But in this particular teaching, he said, first, what's important is it is important to study with a teacher. It's important to study. Or he said, just someone who knows more than we do. I need to study with somebody who knows more than I do. Right? And then if I get to the point where I have understood what that person knows, then I have to find somebody else who knows more than I do. We have to keep going, right? We have to keep going beyond our present understanding. And so while the Dharma ultimately is our teacher, and we will find teachings that challenge us throughout our whole lives, the Dharma has to be embodied. We have to follow that example. We have to work with somebody who can hear us and that we can hear. Who can see us and that we can see. That's important. And then he says we have to inquire, and this is very important, such an important part of the Buddhist tradition. It's an inquiring path, right? It's not passive, right? That's why, you know, here's a moment where, you know, the Taisho is presenting, in a sense, presenting the Dharma and presenting, you know, these are the things that, some of the things that it's important for us to consider. They're important for us to reflect on. And so there's much of that. But ultimately, it means we have to be reaching out and inquiring, examining, wanting to understand, which means leaving the place that we already know. Because we're not learning anything new there. Right? We have to leave home and step away into something new, which is always going to be a little scary, right? So it's like coming here for the first time, it's a little scary. When I came here, it was scary. Right? I really wanted to come, but it was scary. I didn't know what was going to happen. Like, what do they do there? Right? Who's there? What are we going to do? What am I going to be asked to do? But otherwise, nothing changes. And so we have to inquire and examine. And this is, in some ways, the most natural thing, because we're inquisitive beings. But in other ways, it can be very difficult, because that gets kind of stomped out of us a lot. Right? There's much more value in knowing things than inquiring about things. You know, you get rewards for what you know. We don't get much rewards for just having a question. And then the Buddha said we have to withdraw into the body and into the mind. And this is not a rejection, nor is it a withdrawal from the world, although there are times where we come here and we practice and we leave our responsibilities aside for a few hours or a day or longer, so that we can really concentrate. And as we turn, and maybe just think of it as turning your energy from our everyday concerns to the sort of the foundation of where everything's starting and arising from, our desires, the things we identify as, this physical body, sensations, our avoidance of discomfort, our distractedness, our patterns, and so on. And so we have to, in a sense, create a space in which we can begin to move around and look and see and examine and discover the nature of our attachments and karma and distractedness and agitated states. Is it's like being in a room, you know, like these, you know, action movies where somebody's in a room and suddenly all the walls start coming in. You know, and they only have a moment or so before they can break out, which usually they do. This is harder, right? Because it's not quite like that. But it feels like that, right? Where everything's crowding in and the choices get fewer and fewer, right? Our ability to move gets smaller and smaller, reined in. That's why we can so easily feel trapped, confined. And so in that spaciousness, which is a natural state of mind, when those agitations begin to calm, we begin to see. We begin to see this field in which we're working. And then he says we have to practice being virtuous. And this is kind of tricky. I know if I had heard this when I first started, I would have thought, it just sounds too precious. You know, too kind of holy, like, but it's not. That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about just basically being good, just being a good person, right? Like, don't mess it up. Don't mess it up for anybody else. Pretty simple, kind of like some things we were told when we were little, right? Share. Don't beat them up. Right? Don't be a jerk. Right? Take care of things. So to be virtuous, don't create waves of agitation. Right? And it was kind of just be natural in not creating harm, practicing good. And then he said, remember what you've learned. integrate it. Consolidate is actually the way it was translated. Return and again to your zazen and remember what you're experiencing. See. Integrate it. What works? What doesn't? What helps you? What doesn't? What are the behaviors or the cycles that you don't want to repeat? Right? How do you learn not to repeat those? What do you have to do not to repeat those? What are the conditions that make certain actions, certain behaviors, certain patterns easy to get into, easy to get lost in? What can you do about those conditions? Can they be changed, ameliorated? And then he said, be energetic. Have enthusiasm. Right? Like a high-spirited horse. And that means joyful, too. It doesn't just mean, you know, raw, brute energy. It means joyful energy. It's like the energy of life, wanting to live, wanting to be alive. And then he said, no useless talk. Kind of interesting. No useless talk. You know, understand that talk has power, speech has power, and that when we speak, we're occupying our mind, we're filling our consciousness, and we might be filling the consciousness of others. What are we doing? How are we using that force? It's a strong force, right? How long do we think we're going to live? How much time do we have? What should we be doing? This day matters. An important part of Buddhist practice is let everything you can touch, everything you experience, serve your path. Waste nothing. But recognizing what is wasteful, what isn't helping. Let me respectfully remind you, life and death are of great importance, and time does swiftly pass by. And then he said, study the skandhas. The skandhas are the essential teaching, which basically describe how do we both have consciousness, how do we use consciousness, how do we interact with our world, inner and outer, such that we manifest. How's all this working? Study this. See it as it arises. See it as it passes. Understand its nature. And so Haklena whispers in your ear, and do not apply your mind to it. What does that mean? Bodhidharma said, this body is your real body. This real body is your mind. This mind has no beginning or end. Kazan said, here we die, there we are born. It's neither pure nor impure, good nor evil, past or future, male or female. It's not monastic, it's not lay, it's not a sage, it's not foolish. It strives for no realization, it suffers no karma. This mind is what he's describing here. It's like space. You cannot possess it. You cannot lose it. Its virtues are not yours. The actions that arise out of it are yours. Or karma. But this mind is subtle and difficult to realize, Bodhidharma says. It's not the same as the sensual mind. The wise directly encounter it and call this liberation. Nothing can obstruct it. And so, you know, Buddhism teaches two truths. The conventional truth, ordinary reality. You know, as you look around and you sort of figure out how things work, and you work within that place. That's conventional reality. The things we agree upon, more or less. Ultimate reality is what Bodhidharma says, is describing when he says, it's subtle and difficult to realize. Right? It can't measure it. You can't compare it. You can't possess it. No one owns it. No one can give it to you or take it away. And so we can think of practice, because practice, although we use that word, like most things, it can mean anything to you. and still have validity. In other words, we can be practicing sort of within conventional reality. So I do my daily meditation. I see how that calms my mind. That's good. I see how that helps me to be more in contact with things. That's good. It helps me to be less reactive. That's good. These are good things. And so I can practice on the basis of that, in a sense, that conventional reality, and that's what practice is for me. And that's what my way-seeking mind is seeking. That's what I'm looking for. And so, in a sense, that's what appears to me. We can also be practicing within that very same place and have a mind that seeks something ultimate. Yes, this is good, but I am going to die. Right? There's much that is not in my control. The house is on fire, as the Buddha said. I want to be of benefit in this world. What is the underlying basis? What is this mind? And so the teachings, almost all the teachings, much of the teachings, can be understood in both of these ways. So they can sort of speak directly to how to practice, how to apply your mind, and at the same time, for one who is seeking, be coming from the place that Aklāna is speaking. You cannot apply your mind to this. And in actual fact, training is intended to sort of receive us as we enter in that place of conventional reality, right? Where you give me instruction, okay, I have a sense of what I need to do, and I do that. It makes sense. It seems to start working. I feel encouraged. I'm gaining confidence. That's good. And then other things start appearing. And this is where practice is a trajectory. It's like no one knows what's going to happen next. No one knows where this is going to go. Sometimes that's frightening, right? People sometimes, they voice that. They say, I'm worried that if I really get into this, I might want to be a monk. Right? Right? Like you're just, like something's going to take you, you know, and you'll have no choice in the matter. Right? It doesn't work that way. Right? At every step along the way, I mean, bodhicitta isn't something that happens to us, although sometimes it feels like it's not entirely in our control. But nothing can appear without, in a sense, our permission. I mean, you think about it, you know, you're practicing and something suddenly becomes clear or something opens up or you release something. Why now? Why in that moment? Or you see something that's always been there, but you've always sort of like been pretty good at just tucking that away. But now it won't be tucked away. Why now? Because we're ready. Because without knowing it, we have invited that to appear. We have given that permission without even uttering a word. That's the way it unfolds. So we don't have to worry that somehow something's, you know, we're going to lose control. Now, how it unfolds may surprise us. This was a surprise for me. This wasn't part of my plan. I had a plan. This wasn't the plan. This was a better thing than the other thing. So I'm glad my plan didn't work out. How do we study and train and realize that which has no objective existence? From within, this body, this mind, this life, this day. You see the challenge, right? Because if we, in a sense, if we keep it on that place of just our sensual mind, right? This body, this mind, this place, my experiences, good things will happen. But it will be limited, greatly limited, by that very conventional reality. The Buddha said in The Perfection of Wisdom, don't practice to try and increase or decrease objects, feelings, ideas, intentions, your very being. Don't try to appropriate, or extinguish anything. This is the great trust. in reality itself. That within a world in which there is much to do, there are many things we need to work on, much change that needs to happen, both personally and in a large way. Personally and bigly. Right? Within all of that, ultimate reality is ultimate. Right? It can't be increased or decreased. There's a reason why we can't control everything. Maybe it's not of that nature. And so how do we come in accord, as Kazan said? So if you want to accord with enlightened wisdom, it's not just a matter of letting go of attachments. It's not just a matter of developing a more virtuous life. We have to let go from this very body, the one thing we think we are, if anything, and even from the wisdom of the Buddhas. In other words, be free. And being free, then we can use whatever we need. Everything becomes available when we're attached. Very little things become decreasingly available to us. Dogen says, sometimes you study the way by casting off the mind. Sometimes you study the way by taking up the mind. Either way, study the way with thinking and study the way with non-thinking. Again and again and again, we confront the limitations of our dualistic thinking mind. Is it this way or is it this way? Would you, if you just told me, I would know what to do. And so in a certain sense, we're met with that. Okay, start here. And at a certain point, you will reach the end, the limit of that. Now, let go. Let go of letting go. And so within practice, within training, within all the ways we do things, there is no fixed form. There is no ultimate rule. Why do we begin the period with three bells? Somebody did that. Right? Probably for a reason. Right? I'm sure it was for a reason. There's a lot of meaning and symbolism in Buddhism, things in terms of what they represent and how that feeds back into, you know, inspiring us or, you know, conveying a teaching. But is there an ultimate truth in starting the period with three bells? No. But it's a useful way of beginning. Right? The Jigido Kuchis holler out, okay. Action, not action, right? But we respond to sound, and so, bong, bong, affects us in a different way that is conducive to what's happening in that very moment. Study the way with thinking, study the way with not thinking, study. Examine. What would you leave out? What is not important? Last week I said that even the superficial, you know, and recognizing what is, because, you know, in our culture there's so much superficiality. Right? We can spend our whole lives being concerned about things. It's like eating, I don't know, like styrofoam. You know, it kind of fills up the belly, but it, ugh. Right? What does it leave us with? But even within superficiality, all of the teachings are present. Because it's about all of reality. And so study the way, life, people, things, situations, with thinking, reflectively, and non-thinking. How do you do that? I can't tell you. But I can point a way, you've already received that. And then you find out. You see, no one can take you there. No one has ever been taken there. No one can hold us by the hand or stand in front of us and say, now. You have to do that. I have to do that. And that's the good news, because then you realize how powerful you are. You realize the resources that are available to you that you can use and live. But if there's no way to apply the mind, Sinha says, who does the work of Buddhas? Who does this awakening? Who lives a compassionate life? Who hears the cries? How do we wake up? How do we make breakfast? Be in relationship? How do you struggle and learn how to struggle in a way that ceases struggle? If you apply anything, Aklena said, this is not virtuous. This is not bringing forth that which you seek. Just don't contrive anything. You know, it's kind of interesting because in a way this is a contrivance. You know, all of it. Robes, services, zazen, teachings. I mean, if we think of contrivance of just bringing something forth, putting on our clothes, right? Putting salt in your soup, right? Having an opinion. So, what does he mean, don't contrive anything? Cease. So, in zazen, we see the constant non-ceasing mind, creating, 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 doing, doing, building, building, trying to improve, trying to improve. Right? Dukkha is basically being in a state of conflict. This isn't what I want. This isn't working. And so we try and create the reality in our mind or outside of us that we want. And so to not contrive anything means, in your sitting, stop creating. Then, who am I? What is this in that very moment? And then he says, these virtues that you practice do not belong to you. They can't be possessed. But they are virtues. This mind that you awaken is not yours. But it transforms your life. The compassion that you bring forth can't be bought and sold, but it's real. Just don't appropriate. Don't try and accumulate. It's not about that. It isn't of that. Once we see that the self is empty, that the other is not the other, that the past is not the past, the future is not the future. Once we see that home is not home, then we realize that we've never left, that it's all here. Kazan's poem, just don't cover it up. If you want to see the great emptiness, if we want to see the reality of this life, just don't cover it up. Thoroughly empty, pure and peaceful, it is originally clear. So practice does not make it clear. If it is all just like this, how could we cover it up? Well, we have the capacity to see and to not see directly what's in front of us. We have the capacity to hear or to not hear. We have the capacity to move in accord with or to move against. That's how powerful we are. Just don't cover it up. So all of this is for just that. But because we're so conditioned to try and create the world that we think will bring us the peace that we seek, it takes tremendous faith and practice, and trust, and building of confidence, and just experience to begin to let all of that rest, not in passivity, There's nothing passive about this practice, but not in trying to build another self. And so I encourage, particularly those of you here for the weekend, to continue in whatever way is the path of your choosing, right? Whether it's this path, whether it's another path, whether it's wholehearted or half-hearted for now, right? Because it's just now. So how much energy, how much faith, how much patience, how much inquiry do you need to have to start? I don't know. Half a cup? Teaspoon? Enough. You need enough for today. Because you don't know what's going to happen next. I'll end with a poem. A wise person once told me, all the way to heaven is heaven itself. I half didn't believe him. I half did believe. Just enough for the light to sneak in through the door. Just enough for another day. Just enough. Before, I didn't see. How is it now? Let the entire earth come along, and we'll walk together into the scars of the burning.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as meditation cushions, incense, malas, liturgical instruments, books, and more, visit the Monastery Store at monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.